Okay, good morning, everybody. This is BioQ41, and it's October 7th, Thursday. And we're going to move on to sensory physiology today. Last time you had a test, and you're getting them back in lab. They're posted in Blackboard. Unless I didn't see a picture ID, then I don't release the grade until I see your Cypress or Fullerton College picture ID. And you can always see me during office hours, of course, to look at that. But the second test, the average is a lot higher than the first test, like at least 10, maybe 20%. Some people even did 30% better on the second test. But you're still not out of the woods yet. For some people, that still only brought you up to like a 70%, even though you did 20% better than the first test. So if you keep applying yourself, I'm sure you're going to be up in the B and A range on the other tests. So, but now you kind of know what my tests are like. They might be a little bit different compared to some other tests that you've taken and how to prepare for them. The important thing is to use the study guides. That's very important to do that. Okay. Okay, and the online interactive exercises are helpful too. And probably you should think some by the end of the semester, if there's one thing that you've done to pass the class that you would pass on to your best friend, what would that advice be? And you should give that advice to me and I can pass it on to the next class. Okay, so I think we're kind of ready to get started with sensory physiology. And here is the sign-in sheet, so get this started too. Thank you so much. Okay. So in this chapter, we're going to look at receptors. We're going to talk about general senses and what makes them different from special senses, or what makes special senses different from general senses. And in particular, we're going to look at all the senses in the ears and pay a lot of attention to vision. All right, so let's talk about what a sensory receptor is. It is some kind of device that will transduce energy from one modality into another modality. All right, so it's going to change maybe light energy into the kind of energy that your brain can understand. And I mentioned once before what the language that the brain uses, right? And it's the language that is transmitted by axons through your nervous system. And so what is that language that your brain uses to understand what's happening in the environment and even to talk to different divisions within itself? Those are action potentials, right? Just action potentials. So it's just a string of blips, and that's the information. As the frequency of those blips increases, that means the intensity increases, and as the frequency decreases, the intensity decreases. But every action potential is exactly the same, same amplitude, same duration, right? It's just the frequency of them is what matters. All right, and so each type of receptor responds best to a particular modality or form of energy. So for instance, there are receptors in our eyes that respond to light. They respond to light the best. Not that they can't respond to other kinds of stimuli, but they're most sensitive to light. Like maybe have you ever hit your head by accident, maybe around your eyes, and you saw flashes of light? Well, those weren't really flashes of light in the room. That was just a mechanical deformation of the retina, which then produced action potentials that went to the visual center of your brain. And your brain, whenever it gets action potentials in that visual center, gives you the sensation that you're seeing light. So different modalities are perceived as different because of the different regions within the central nervous system or brain that receive action potentials. All right, so that's how you understand your environment. Was there a question? No? Okay. So different parts of the brain, for instance, if we artificially stimulate the occipital lobe, then you will see things, right? Because that's your visual center. If we artificially stimulate a certain part of the temporal lobe, you will hear things, even though that those things really aren't occurring in the environment. All right, so the sensory receptors sometimes can be really simple dendritic endings of neurons. Like, for instance, in this picture of the integument, I see some nerves surrounding this hair follicle right here, and they're just free nerve endings. And so when this hair follicle moves back and forth, that will start action potentials going to the brain, and you'll get the sense that, the wind is blowing over your skin, or these hairs are rubbing up against your clothing, or something like that. Other free sensory neurons that we have in the dermis are for temperature. So temperature are free nerve endings. And also pain are free nerve endings. So there's lots of different kinds of modalities that just utilize free nerve endings. And then there are others that are pretty complicated. Right? There's specialized nerve endings like this Pacinian corpuscle here, or Ruffini's end organs, or Meissner's corpuscle. And these respond to deformation. So when something is vibrating your skin or pressing on your skin, then these things cause depolarization of these neurons, which then send what? Action potentials to the brain. So these are all for different kinds of vibration and touch. For instance, Pacinian corpuscles are really deep in the skin, and so these are for deep pressure. Others like this Meissner's corpuscle are very superficial, so you can tell very light kinds of pressure or vibration with these kinds of receptors. All right, and you have these receptors all over in your skin, but mostly where you have the highest density will be in your hands and fingertips, okay, and probably maybe your lips and on certain parts of your face as well. But you have these receptors everywhere. And since you have these kinds of receptors everywhere in your body, we call these the sensation of vibration and touch and pressure and temperature and pain, a general sense. So for instance, you have free nerve endings that can sense temperature all over your body. So if I took an ice cube and put it on your earlobe, you could say what? Oh, that's cold. Or if I put it on your kneecap, you could say that's cold. Or your back, or your belly button, or whatever, you could tell what temperature it is. Since you have receptors all over your body, then that's a general sense. Okay. So another general sense, which maybe is not so obvious, is proprioception. Proprioception is a sense, it's kind of an unconscious sense, so it does raise to the level of consciousness sometimes. It's a sense of body position. Right, even with your eyes closed, if I were to take your hand and put it above your head and ask you where is your right hand at, you could tell where it was. Because you have receptors in all muscles of your body, all joints in your body, and tendons that tell what the position of a muscle is, what kind of tension it's producing, and from that you can figure out what position your body is in. And since you have those receptors all over, right, that is a general sense. Even though proprioception sounds like kind of a special sense, it's general because you have all those receptors all over your body. Okay, so here are sensory receptors grouped according to the type of stimulus they transduce. So what does that term transduce mean once again? It's to take, change information, like chemical information into... the concentration of a chemical into what? Into action potentials, right? Or change light into action potentials. Or change temperature into action potentials, right? So that's what a transducer is. So you have chemoreceptors that can sense the chemical concentrations of various kinds of chemicals in your body. Like, let's talk about a couple. Like, what would be important chemicals that your body should be able to measure? Oh, calcium, sodium would be really good because that's the basis of synaptic transmission and how you depolarize a membrane. But hydrogen ion, because pH is very important. There are central receptors in your brain. How about glucose receptors? Oh, absolutely, right? So there are all different kinds of chemical receptors in different locations of your body. And then photoreceptors. You don't have a lot of different locations for photoreceptors, but just your eyes, for instance. Thermoreceptors, we said, were all over your body on your skin. There's even thermoreceptors in your brain that measure your core body temperature to help regulate your body temperature. Right? Mechanoreceptors respond to deformation of a cell membrane, like those Pacinian corpuscles and Meissner's corpuscles. And nociceptors respond to damaging kinds of stimuli to your body. So these are pain receptors. And that those kinds of pain receptors can sense maybe a high acid concentration or ripping and tearing. So it can be mechanical or it could be chemical. And then these were the last ones that I just talked about, the proprioceptors that give your brain information about the position of different body parts. And these are in every muscle, joint capsule, and tendon, proprioceptors. And that's a general sense. So of this list right here, not all of these are general senses, All right, this one right here, photoreceptors. This is not a general sense because if I were to shine a flashlight on your kneecap, could you see it? No. Or your belly button? Or your earlobe? No, you can only sense photons or light on your eyes. So that's what we call a special sense. So a special sense is a little bit different because you only have one or two locations where you're sensitive to that modality of energy. All right, and there are some chemoreceptors that are special senses as well. Like for instance, if I take a sugar cube and put it on your belly button or your elbow or kneecap, can you taste it? No. But if you put it on your tongue, you can taste sweet, right? So the sense of taste, which we call gustatory sense, that's a special sense because it only occurs in one location in your body. So just because you know the general type of sensory receptor, you don't really know for sure if it's general or special until we talk about it exactly. Okay. All right, so that's another way, a very important way that we talk about senses, and that's by location, right? There are general senses versus special senses. General means that you have that ability to sense that energy all over your body, but a special sense means that only one or two locations, and usually it's a very complicated organ. It's a very, very organized organ that allows you to do that, like an eye or an ear. And we're going to talk about some of these different organs in this chapter. So we're mostly going to focus our attention on special senses and special receptors. All right, some other general classifications of receptors before we start talking about special receptors. There are either tonic receptors or phasic receptors. And tonic receptors respond at a constant rate as long as the stimulus is applied in a constant manner, as long as the stimulus does not change. So for instance, if we apply a stimulus at this point in time and keep it on until this point in time and then turn it off, look at the frequency of action potentials. Notice that it never changes frequency. It's the same frequency. And of course, what about the amplitude? It's the same, and the duration of those action potentials are the same too. That has really nothing to do about this stimulus right here. That speaks to what? Just about the nature of action potentials in general, right? Action potentials never change their amplitude or intensity. And information is coded how? By the frequency of these action potentials, okay? And so these kinds of receptors never habituate a signal. So it's important, for instance, for pain receptors to be tonic receptors because you don't ever want to forget about some kind of stimulus that is damaging your body. You want to take some kind of action to, what, alleviate or prevent that damage to your body. So these receptors, all right, never habituate or adapt to the stimulus. As opposed to phasic receptors, which is the second kind right over here, they respond with a burst of activity, high-frequency action potentials when the stimulus is applied, but if the stimulus is maintained, notice that the frequency of action potentials decreases, and less information actually reaches your brain. You're less aware that that stimulus is being applied to your body. So that happens, for instance, in smell and touch. I think when you put your clothes on this morning, you felt the clothes sliding over your body, but right now, that hasn't reached your consciousness at all because all those tactile receptors have adapted to the pressure of all that clothing that you have put on. And it would really be a distraction to your everyday life, right, if you had to account for all that information that was going to your brain all the time, like your shoes right now on your feet, right? That really doesn't matter to you one way or the other in terms of your health, whether or not you're wearing shoes, so that information really is not important, okay? Smell, you're probably aware of. Maybe I always think of a library. Libraries have a tendency to have kind of a characteristic smell because of all the books that are in them. And when you walk into a library, you go, oh, I'm in the library, right? We could blindfold you, have you walk into the library, and you could know. But then maybe after about a half hour, then all that smell, that olfactory information, those receptors have adapted, and you can't smell the library after that. Okay. So those are a couple examples. And differences between tonic versus phasic receptors. Here's a pretty important law, and this is the law of specific nerve energies, and it just says that a receptor will respond best to only one kind of energy, right? Like the photoreceptors in your eye will respond best to photons, not that they can't respond to other kinds of stimuli, but they just do it best for light, for instance, And then light is what we call an adequate stimulus for that particular kind of receptor. So, for instance, if we shine light on a chemoreceptor, it's not going to respond, but if we turn the intensity of light way up, right, then maybe it eventually will depolarize and send some kind of chemical information to your brain, which will be misinterpreted. All right, so that's not an adequate stimulus. The adequate stimulus would be that particular chemical that would bind to a receptor and signal action potentials to the brain. All right, so the adequate stimulus is one that requires the least amount of energy to activate its receptor. So we got mechanical receptors for mechanical force, pain receptors, monitor tissue damage, chemoreceptors, monitor chemicals, and of course photoreceptors, monitor light. So this is a pretty good table for you to look over. All right, so the general scheme for senses is that there are usually receptor cells which generate or produce generator potentials. And on the slide right here, I see generator potentials in yellow, and that will stimulate an action potential, which could be a whole bunch of different colors, but we'll say red. Is that red?
Yes.
Yeah, good. Okay. Okay, so these generator potentials that are being produced by receptor cells, all right, are similar to what kinds of potentials that we looked at before?
Graded
potentials, right? Because there's a difference in magnitude, right? And of course, they can summate, and they can have different durations and different amplitudes depending on the intensity of the stimulus that is being applied. And once this generator potential reaches threshold, then that will cause an action potential in this nerve. Now, what kind of nerve does this look like to you? Is this an afferent nerve, an efferent nerve? It's a sensory nerve, which is afferent, right, which is taking information from your periphery into the central nervous system. Yeah, so that's really what we're going to focus our attention on. So generator potentials are equivalents of excitatory postsynaptic potentials, which can summate, right, and they can reach threshold that will cause an action potential to go to the brain. And remember that we have this area, right, of hyperpolarization after the action potential, and this is what regulates the frequency of action potentials going to the brain. So as the generator potential increases, it has an easier ability to overcome this area of hyperpolarization, which means an action potential can come at a sooner time, right? So as these generator potentials increase, the amplitude increases, then the frequency of action potentials to the brain increases as well, because this relative refractory period can be overcome with a higher than normal depolarization. All right, so generator potentials are proportional to stimulus intensity, and after threshold is reached, the action potential frequency is then proportional to the amplitude because of that relative refractory period. Right, in phasic receptors, the generator potential adapts to the constant stimulus, right, and then quickly diminishes in amplitude. So when your body adapts to a stimulus, it's not due to changes in the neuron, it's due to changes in the receptor itself. Neurons hardly ever fatigue. They will be able to create action potentials without any kind of fatigue. All right, so for an example, for a tonic receptor, where we turn a stimulus on and off, here we have a sub-threshold stimulus, right? And so no action potentials are produced. When it becomes a threshold stimulus, right, this small area right here above threshold is not enough to overcome the relative refractory period, so the rate of action potentials being generated here is relatively slow because it has to recover from that relative refractory period. But if it's a very strong stimulus, like we see in this third case right here, the generator potential is high enough to overcome the relative refractory period, and so an action potential is instituted at a much higher rate. So it's easy for your brain to tell intensity just by the frequency of action potentials. That's kind of a review from last time. All right, so let's talk about some special senses. And let's see what these special senses are. Let's just kind of write them down. So vision is a special sense, right? You can only see light with your eyes. And the sense of smell, because you can only smell with your nose, not your belly button, elbow, or anything like that, fingertip, right? So does anybody know what the name of that sense is? Probably from anatomy, you know. That's the olfactory sense, yeah. Smell is olfaction, okay? Now taste, I don't think we talked about in anatomy at all. That is the gustatory sense, gustation, G-U-S-T-A-T-I-O-N, gustation is taste. All right, so we got vision, olfaction, gustation, that's three, right? Vision, yeah, that's three. And then we got hearing, okay, that's four. And then we have equilibrium, which is another one, all right? And equilibrium we kind of break down into two special senses, so I don't know if you want to call it one or two. But you should know there's at least five. And the fifth one, equilibrium, there are two involved with that, and we're going to talk about those. All right, so let's start with taste and smell. These we would classify as exteroreceptors because they respond to chemicals not in our internal environment but the external environment. So they're exteroreceptors. So they're ways that we communicate with our environment, right? And interoceptors, on the other hand, would respond to chemicals in the internal environment, like blood glucose or pH, for instance, in the brain. Oh, what is pH really a measure of? Why is it a chemical? Yeah, it's a measure of hydrogen ion concentration, right? Hydrogen ion concentration. So it's really a chemical that we're measuring. Okay, so let's talk about taste. Taste originates on our tongue because we have taste buds on our tongue. Now, if you look in the mirror and try to find taste buds, right, you'll be looking at them, but here is a taste bud, right, a nice illustration, and a taste bud we can see has a handful of cells. Maybe it has 100 or 200 cells, but that's about it. All right, and can you see cells with your naked eye? No. Absolutely not. So taste buds really are microscopic. All right, when you look at the surface of your tongue, you look at things that some people consider taste buds, but what are those little things that are poking up off your tongue? From anatomy, we call those papillae. Okay, papillae. And there's different kinds, right? You have the valley papillae, different kinds of papillae. And lining all, so right here is a, right, a zoomed-in region of a papillae, and every papillae has thousands or even millions of these structures right here that we call a taste bud, right? So we're looking at a very, very small microscopic area. These are within the epithelium of the tongue, and then here is an opening, which we call a taste pore to a taste bud. And every taste bud has different receptor cells that have these little projections like cilia poking off the apical end right here that we call taste hairs. But they're not really hairs, right? They're really like cilia that have receptors on them. And that will change the electrical activity of the taste cell right here, which then will secrete neurotransmitters and stimulate this sensory neuron right here, which then will take action potentials to the brain. All right, and for taste, we recognize that there are five primary taste sensations. They're sweet, sour, salty, bitter, and there is something called umami, which responds to amino acids, and it gives you the sense of fulfillment or deliciousness, right? And one amino acid that really stimulates these receptors would be glutamate, right? Then glutamate is an amino acid. Okay, so you have all these taste receptor cells within a taste bud, and each taste bud can respond to these different categories, these four categories of tastes. And that's kind of interesting because all the tastes that you're aware of can be broken down into these fundamental tastes. All right, sweet, sour, salty, and bitter. And maybe an example that I would use, I should actually do this and demonstrate it in class someday, and that is, how about a margarita? When you taste a margarita, all right, it's a complex mixture, but would you mix it for, like, peppermint? Can you mix it up with peppermint? Or would you know that it's a margarita? Because what would you taste? Well, first a little salty taste, and you taste sweet and sour and bitter, right? And the proper mixture of all those things would tell you that you're actually drinking a margarita. All right, so how does this taste bud take chemicals that are in your mouth and transduce them into action potentials that go to the brain? Okay, and so I think that's what we have on these next couple slides right here. So here are the taste cells that make up a taste bud, and we've got four different kinds of general schemes. The first two are really easy to appreciate. For salty, okay, what makes up salt, like table salt that's on your table? Just sodium chloride, all right? And so what does your body use sodium for? Where do you find a high concentration of sodium? Yeah, outside the cell. And if it goes inside the cell, what happens to the cell? It depolarizes, right, and goes up toward threshold. So that's an excitatory event. So when you put salt in your mouth, there are sodium channels in these taste receptor cells in these taste buds. And so just by diffusion, sodium will enter the cell, depolarizing the cell. And when the cell depolarizes, that opens calcium channels. And calcium enters, and that causes the release of neurotransmitter that's produced by this taste cell, and it diffuses across the synaptic cleft, causes depolarization on this gustatory afferent neuron, which then takes action potentials to the brain. So just by putting salt in your mouth, namely sodium, that depolarizes the cell, and that starts a bunch of action potentials going to the brain that then goes to the taste center. Okay. Other kinds of taste cells, for sour, for instance, sour is due to acid. And, of course, acid produces what? Hydrogen ions, free hydrogen ions in solution. And this kind of taste cell doesn't have sodium channels in the membrane, but it has hydrogen ion channels that are specific for hydrogen ion. So when the acidity of your mouth increases, those hydrogen ions enter the cell, and hydrogen is a cation just like sodium is. So what happens to the membrane potential of this taste cell when hydrogen ions? It depolarizes, okay? And again, it's going to cause, when it depolarizes, it's going to cause opening of calcium channels, which then will cause fusion of excitatory neurotransmitter into the synaptic cleft, causing action potentials on this afferent neuron, right? And then these go to a different part of the brain compared to this neuron over here. These go to the ones that are connect up to the appreciation for salt. These over here go to the part of the brain for appreciation of sour. All right, so now you can tell the difference between salty and sour because different parts of your brain are receiving action potentials, right? And that defines the reality right there. Okay, we got a couple other ones to look at. For sweet and umami, these don't respond to ion channels, or these are, or ion channels don't, are not responsible for these tastes, but these are through G proteins, right? And you're kind of familiar with G proteins. So there is like a, for a G protein, as opposed to just an ion channel, for an ion channel, you don't have a first messenger and second messenger because why? The messenger outside the cell actually enters, right, and causes depolarization. But for a G protein, we always have a first messenger and a second messenger in the transduction scheme. So the first messenger always stays outside the cell, but it causes changes inside, mediated by these G proteins right here. So there are different kinds of receptors that have the proper shape so glucose can bind to them. That's going to activate this G protein, which then produces a second messenger inside the cell. This second messenger will then activate other kinds of ion channels in the cell. It's going to close a potassium channel for sweet and umami right here. So let's just say that when, in the absence of stimulation, in the absence of a chemical molecule, these potassium channels are open. Okay, and okay, when these potassium channels are open, it allows for that's not making sense to me right at the moment. Potassium channels close. So let's just say that in the absence of stimulation, the potassium is open, so potassium would have a tendency to, you know what, it's going to have a tendency to leak in, right? And when potassium leaks in, no, potassium is going to leak out, and when potassium is leaking out of the cell, what's happening? Okay, so in the absence of stimulation, when potassium is leaking out of the cell, that's going to hyperpolarize, that's going to drive it farther away from threshold, that's going to inhibit the cell. It's not going to release neurotransmitter. But when second messenger is present, when there is a sugar molecule, okay, it's going to close the potassium channel. So instead of hyperpolarizing the cell, it's going to depolarize the cell. That depolarization is going to cause release of neurotransmitter. Okay, so that's what's happening. So think of potassium. All right, when these channels are open, it hyperpolarizes, and when they close, that depolarizes the cell, which is what? An excitatory event that's going to cause release of neurotransmitter. That's for sweet and umami. For bitter, all right, like a quinine molecule that you would have in tonic water, for instance, will bind to a receptor, and that works through a G protein, which again causes an increase in second messenger. And now this second messenger is not going to act on ion channels in the membrane, but it's going to act on ion channels in the sarcoplasmic reticulum or endoplasmic reticulum, and in particular, calcium channels. And smooth endoplasmic reticulum, remember, has two functions. One is to make lipids and phospholipids. And another function of smooth endoplasmic reticulum is that it can store calcium ions, right? So there are calcium pumps that pump calcium in here, and when the calcium channels open up, calcium just rushes out by diffusion, and that calcium then is like another second messenger that's going to cause fusion of these synaptic vesicles, releasing neurotransmitter, excitatory neurotransmitter on this afferent neuron, and that generates action potentials to the brain. And the reason why that you can tell the difference between sweet, for instance, and bitter is because these two neurons go to two different locations in the brain. If they go to the same location in the brain, then you couldn't differentiate the taste at all, right? Okay. So different parts of the brain will give you different sensations. All right, so before I switch to the next slide, who's got a question on this? Any question on this? All right, just remember, sodium and salty and sour, those are really simple ion channels. All the other taste sensations are work through G proteins that produce second messengers. In one case, it can change the permeability to potassium, which depolarizes the cell. In the second case, it causes release of calcium, and that changes the frequency of action potentials going to the brain. All right, so this is for the sense of gustation. All right, so that takes us to olfaction. Okay, and you're kind of familiar with this from anatomy lab. Like here's a nice ethmoid bone right here, and you've got the cribriform plate with all these olfactory foramina. And this is a pretty interesting part of the body because this epithelium right here, it lines the nasal cavity. So this nasal cavity is really outside your body, right? I mean, it's inside your nasal cavity, but that's really outside your body. And this is the only place where you can actually find neurons, like I see this nice bipolar neuron, actually exiting and existing outside of your body. All right, so, and as you can imagine, since it's not surrounded by your body, they have a pretty rough lifestyle, right? So whatever you're breathing through your nose, affects these neurons right here because nothing is surrounding them or protecting them. And because of that, these neurons don't live for a very long period of time, but fortunately there are stem cells within this epithelium, right, that replace these bipolar neurons maybe about every 2 weeks or so in most cases, unless they were damaged too. All right, so this is kind of strange because usually neurons don't regenerate themselves, but here is a really good example of where clearly they do. All right, so what are the kinds of cells that we have? We have these bipolar neurons, and this is typically where we find bipolar neurons is with special senses, no other place in the body. We have special other kinds of cells that help try to protect these bipolar neurons by detoxifying things that we breathe into our nose, and there are also stem cells that can regenerate and make connections from the bipolar cells, okay, up into these neurons in the olfactory bulb that will take action potentials to the brain. All right, and these bipolar cells have like little hairs sticking off of them with receptors on them as well. And the receptors for smell is much more complicated compared to gustation. There are thousands of different classes of olfactory receptors, but they all work through G-protein coupled receptors, right, which then change action potentials going to the brain. So it's much more complicated, and we don't know that much about it. Okay, so the receptor cells, you got support cells, which are the stem cells. Okay, and then each of these neurons will go to a different part of the brain for you to appreciate different sensations of smells. The molecules that bind to receptors are what we call odor molecules, and they all work through G proteins. And so an odorant molecule has to bind to a receptor before you have the sensation of smell. And so I think that's all that you have to know for this class. Okay, but maybe try to use the model for taste, but it's just much more complicated. Okay, so let's go to the ear. Yeah. Oh, the different receptors for smell. Okay, for taste, there are basically five. Okay, but for smell, we don't even know how many there are yet. There could be 2,000, there could be 4,000 different kinds of individual receptors for the different shapes of odorant molecules. And so people are still trying to figure that out, exactly how that all works. Okay, the only thing we know for sure is that an odorant molecule has to bind to a receptor on the cell membrane of that bipolar cell before you'll have the sensation of smell. Okay, so there has to be binding of an odorant molecule to a receptor, and all of the receptors are G proteins. So none of those odorant molecules have to enter the body. That signal is transduced by this G protein, so it causes the buildup of a second messenger inside the bipolar cell. Okay. Okay, ears and hearing. Let me skip through these a little bit until we get to... Oh, good. Thank goodness. Okay, here's a typical kind of anatomy figure. Okay, so make sure you're familiar with the different parts of the ear. Of course, you got the outer ear with the pinna right here, the external auditory meatus, and it stops right here at the tympanic membrane. And then you have the middle ear, beginning at the tympanic membrane. You have three tiny, tiny bones in the middle ear that pick up vibrations from the tympanic membrane and pass them on to the inner ear. And this tympanic membrane right here should have equal pressure on either side of it, right? If there's high pressure in the external auditory meatus, then it's going to push the tympanic membrane all the way into the middle ear, and it will hold it there, and it won't be able to vibrate. And sound is a mechanical wave moving through air that's vibrating above atmospheric pressure and then a little bit below, above and below, which causes the vibration. So if the tympanic membrane is pushed all the way to the inside and it can't vibrate, then you can't hear anything. Okay, so there should be equal pressure on either side of the tympanic membrane. And what equalizes pressure, right, is this eustachian tube right here, which actually goes to your throat. All right, so sometimes when you go up in an airplane, for instance, your ears feel like they're plugged up. You don't hear very well because what happens, you have high pressure in the middle ear, and as you go up in the airplane, the pressure in the plane decreases, and it has a tendency to push the tympanic membrane all the way to the outside, and then it can't vibrate as well, which means then you can't hear, right? The tympanic membrane has to vibrate these auditory ossicles. All right, so a lot of times you might swallow or chew gum or pressurize your nose, pressurize your throat to force some air up in here, equalize the pressure so that that can restore your hearing. Unless if you have a cold or really bad allergies or something, and this tympanic membrane is plugged up, you can't equalize, and then the tympanic membrane is going to be pressurized more and more and more, and that can produce a lot of pain when that happens. Yeah. The tube? Yeah, eustachian tube. Oh, it's got a bunch of different names. Sometimes it's called auditory tube, but it goes between the pharynx and the middle chamber of the ear. So it's called auditory tube, eustachian tube, or pharyngotympanic tube. That's how anatomy is sometimes, right? A lot of different names for the same thing. But you see it right here to equalize pressure. And of course, little kids, you know, one-year-olds and two-year-olds, a lot of times they have otitis media, right, infection of the middle ear right here, or a sore throat, they can't equalize, right? And when they're traveling in an airplane, they're misbehaving because they have really bad ear pain because of that, right? Unfortunately. And I probably couldn't recommend that you put them on a course of antihistamines or other kinds of things. Talk to your pediatrician about that, right? If you got to travel with little kids. But that certainly might help them out. Okay, so this arrangement right here takes vibrations from the external acoustic meatus to the inner ear right here. And so there is a little membrane on the vestibular apparatus that we call the oval window. And look at the difference in surface area. The oval window is really small compared to the tympanic membrane. So this acts as a way to amplify the sound signal, but also match some of the physical properties of air to the properties of the fluid that's inside the inner ear. And the fluid inside the inner ear is basically water, right? The fluid in the outer ear over here is just gas. And so it's very hard for energy to go from air into water. Maybe you recognize that if you were ever swimming sometime. If your head is underwater, you hear people above the pool talking. Hardly at all, right? Because sound energy doesn't like to go in water. So we have to have this little special transducing device right here. And that allows the sound energy to enter the water environment of the inner ear. Okay. What else do I want to say about middle ear? That's about it. Maybe from anatomy you could look at some little muscles in there, know the names of these bones, but that's all I'm going to say. Okay, so what sense are we talking about? We're talking about hearing. Okay, also though, in the inner ear we have two other senses for equilibrium, this two different positional senses. So for hearing, of course, we need an external ear, we need a middle ear, and an inner ear. For the other senses of the ear, we only need the inner ear. For equilibrium, we only need the inner ear. You don't need the pinna right here. You don't need a auditory meatus for the sense of equilibrium. All right, so this little thing that kind of looks like a snail right here, that's what we call the cochlea. And this right here is what we call the vestibule. And it's got a number of different sense organs that we're going to take a look at. These organs then send information to the brain via the vestibulocochlear nerve, right? Because here's the cochlea and here's the vestibule. It used to be called, what, just the auditory nerve until people realized that it is also sending equilibrium information to the brain. All right, these semicircular canals right here give us the sense of angular acceleration. Well, what is acceleration? How about velocity? What is velocity? In your car, you have a little meter that tells you what your velocity is. What's that called? That's a speedometer. It tells you how fast you're going in miles per hour, right? And velocity just means that's just miles per hour. What acceleration is when your velocity is changing, maybe going up or going down. So acceleration is going from 0 to 60 miles an hour in a second, for instance. That would be you're accelerating. Or deceleration is when you're going from a high velocity to a low velocity. So acceleration is change in velocity, and that's what the vestibular apparatus can do for us. Can tell us if our velocity is changing. It can't tell us what speed we're going at. It can just tell us if we're speeding up or slowing down in one of two ways. Speeding up in a linear direction, either right, left, or forwards and backwards. The semicircular canals will tell us if our velocity is changing in an angular sense. And another way of saying that is spinning. If the velocity of spin is changing for these three semicircular canals right here. All right, so let's go back and I'm going to flip through a bunch of slides again. Okay, so here we have the cochlea. The cochlea is important for hearing. All right, and then here we have the vestibule, has two parts. This part right here is for linear acceleration, and the semicircular canals are important for angular acceleration. All right, and that acceleration gives us a sense of equilibrium, and it's oriented to gravity because gravity doesn't change for us. Okay. The vestibular apparatus has some otolith organs like the utricle and saccule right here. And otolith organs means that there are little crystals in this part of the ear that act as weights. All right, and what can you tell me about a weight? If something, depending on the size of that weight, gravity will pull on it with a different force. All right, so these things can measure the force of gravity because it has otoliths or crystals in it. The semicircular canals have a different kind of organ that we're going to look at. Okay. So inside the bony labyrinth of the cochlea, there is a membranous lining to it, and there are different fluid compartments. In the very inner part, we have endolymph, and then on the outer parts, we have perilymph, the lymph that is surrounding, all right, the endolymph right here. Okay, so on this slide, I want you to know how many semicircular canals do we have in each ear? There are three, and that matches up with the three planes that you need to define space, right, in our world. And so you have, what, a coronal plane, and you have a transverse plane, and a sagittal plane. And so you can appreciate spin in each one of those three planes, right? And if you're spinning maybe not in a sagittal plane, but maybe at an oblique plane, then you're going to have some combination of two or three semicircular canals sending action potentials to the brain so that you can tell that you're spinning at some kind of oblique angle. All right, and it's rare that you'll maybe be spinning in just exactly one direction. Okay, so utricle and saccule provide for linear acceleration, the semicircular canals for angular acceleration. So how does this happen? Well, in these areas right here that we call the ampulla of the semicircular canals, as well as the utricle and saccule, right, there are special organs that have cells that we call hair cells. So here we have a hair cell, and they have cilia poking up on the apical surface of these hair cells. We call these stereocilia. And they can bend back and forth, and they're eventually connected to this special cilium right here that we call a kinocilium. And depending on which way these cilia bend on the hair cells, it can cause depolarization or hyperpolarization of this receptor cell, which then will cause what? Either will cause graded potentials, which will release neurotransmitters on the vestibular cochlear nerve, which then can change the rate of action potentials going to the brain. So for instance, if these stereocilia bend to the left, that depolarizes the cell. We have a high rate of action potentials going to the brain. If they bend to the right, right, the cell will be inhibited, and we have, what, a much lower frequency of action potentials going to the equilibrium centers within the brain. All right, so these are what we call hair cells. So let's look at the utricle and saccule. So What part of the ear are we looking at right now? Outer, middle, or inner? The inner ear, okay, and inside the vestibule. And here is a membrane. And here are the hair cells. So here are the receptor cells. And they synapse on the vestibulocochlear nerve. So this is just an epithelium within the utricle and saccule. And on top of the epithelium, there is a gelatinous mass. So here is some gelatin, and embedded in the gelatin we have these little crystals, calcium carbonate crystals, that act as weights. So for instance, this one right here, so this organ is what we call the maculae, and when your head is upright, then these weights push straight down on the stereocilia, and they don't bend one way or the other. But if you were to tilt your head forward, right, then gravity is going to pull down on this gelatin because embedded in the gelatin are the otoliths, and it's going to bend the stereocilia down like this, and that's going to change the electrical properties of this hair cell, which then change the rate of action potentials going to the brain. And so you have a sense of head position, whether your head is upright or lying down, okay, because of the way these stereocilia are bent by this gelatinous mass and the otoliths within that mass right there. All right, so the utricle is sensitive to horizontal acceleration. Oh, the thing that I didn't say is that gravity works like acceleration. And I don't have time to really talk about that very much. But, for instance, if you're in a car, okay, and your head is upright, and you hit the accelerator, all right, these hair cells are going to bend, right? Because these otoliths will want to stay in one position while the car is accelerating. All right, so they'll want to stay behind, and they'll bend these hair cells backwards like that. And then when you stop, what happens? Then the otoliths will want to keep going, and it's going to bend these hair cells forward, again, sending different kinds of information to the brain. All right, so the utricle sends information on horizontal acceleration, and the saccule for vertical acceleration, because they're oriented in different directions. So what is that property of mass? That mass wants to stay, if it's not moving, it wants to stay stationary. Or if it is moving, it wants to stay moving. It's called a property of inertia. Yeah, that's inertia. So we can kind of demonstrate that with a little water bottle right here. And Thanksgiving is coming up, and you should actually do this experiment Thanksgiving. All right, you, nice tablecloth on a table, and put a bunch of wine glasses and candlesticks and stuff like that. And what can you do? You can take the tablecloth, okay, and pull it out from all of those objects, because all those objects have inertia, which means that they want to stay exactly right where they are. They don't want to move, right? So during Thanksgiving, you could do something like that and just really impress a lot of people and not make a mess at all, okay? All right, but what is the other property that mass has? If it's stationary, it wants to stay stationary, but once it's moving, it doesn't want to stop. It wants to keep moving, which is a different kind of thing. So we take that same mass, and we'll start out slow, because if we did it fast, what would happen? It just wants to stay there. But if we start slow, we can get the mass moving, and then we'll stop fast. We'll stop the paper fast, but what's going to happen to my orange juice? It's going to want to keep moving, okay? So we get it going, and then we stop it fast, and you can see that it still wants to move. So that's the same thing with these otoliths right here. If you're accelerating, okay, they will force these stereocilia to move one way or the other, and that will give your the sense of body position as a result. Okay, the semicircular canals kind of operate the same way, right? They don't have maculae. The maculae are in the utricle and saccule over here. There's a little bit of different apparatus in this little bulge at the base of the semicircular canals that we call the ampulla, and the organ for sensing rotational acceleration is what we call the crista ampullaris. All right, so the maculae sense linear acceleration, the crista ampullaris senses rotational acceleration. So let's see how that can happen. Well, since this is a semicircular canal, this fluid can flow in a circle, right? Because if it flows over in this direction, it eventually ends back up over here. The same thing in the horizontal plane. Same thing in the sagittal plane right here. This fluid can just flow around in a circle if you are what? If you are spinning in a circle. Okay. So let's look at the crista ampullaris. Here is the crista ampullaris. We're within the ampule of a semicircular canal. So there's a little bit of a bulge in the epithelial membrane, but nonetheless there are still hair cells that have stereocilia poking up into the cupula right here. And the cupula is a gelatinous mass that can bend backwards and forwards. Okay. And inside of the canal, of the semicircular canal, is endolymph. And that endolymph is like my orange juice. So if you're not spinning, what's the state of that endolymph? If you're not spinning for a long time, it's just stationary. And does it want to move? If all of a sudden you start spinning, does that endolymph want to move? No, it wants to stay stationary. But when you start to spin, right, the crista ampullaris here, since it's attached to your head, starts to spin immediately. But the fluid doesn't spin, so that's like having a flow of fluid over the cupula, and it's going to push the cupula in the opposite direction that you're spinning, right? Because the fluid is stationary and the cupula is moving. All right, so now let's just say that you've been spinning for a minute. What happens to the endolymph? It catches up, right? It catches up and starts to spin with your body, and then you stop all of a sudden, All right, which means that the cupula stops spinning, but what happens to the endolymph? It still wants to spin around, and so then it bends the cupula back the other way, and that changes the rate of frequency, that changes the frequency of action potentials going to the brain. Okay, and so the semicircular canals are good for spinning or what? Angular acceleration, and the saccule and utricle are good for linear acceleration, just because of the structure of the various organs. Yeah. Definitely has a lot to do with vertigo. So for instance, and we used to do this, I'm sure, as kids, and maybe you still do it at home, is what? Spin. Okay, so if you start spinning, and you get that endolymph going in one direction, and you stop, and then you open your eyes, right, you get all that information from the crista ampullaris that your body is really spinning because the endolymph is still moving. And you open your eyes, and you see, like, your world kind of moving in front of your eyes. Eventually, you know, it stops moving when the endolymph stops spinning. And that inappropriate sense of seeing the world spin in front of you when you're not really spinning or the world is not spinning, right, that's vertigo. So you can artificially create vertigo, or if there's damage to the crista ampullaris, or if there's damage to these nerves right here, if they become hypersensitive to neurotransmitters, and that will produce inappropriate sensations of motion, which we call vertigo. Yeah. And
so that can occur
without actually spinning. Yeah, that can occur without spinning. And I suppose that happens when you imbibe toxic compounds. I don't know if anybody's ever experienced that. But for instance, if you've had too much ethyl alcohol, you might not be able to stop your world from spinning. Okay? Because what? That's toxic to these neurons right here. It's not that the endolymph is doing any spinning in your head, it's just that the activity of these neurons has been altered. Okay? And there's many other conditions that can produce that. And that's also kind of the case that happens that produces motion sickness as well. When these things, for instance, if you're out on the ocean or if you're driving through a mountainous road or something that has a lot of curves in it, and that's because the visual information that you're getting doesn't match up with the equilibrium sense that you're getting from your ears, and that just produces a dysphoria. Right, inappropriate sensations that your mind really doesn't know how to justify. Okay, because your eyes say you're not spinning, but your ears say you are spinning, and it just produces a really nasty kind of sensation. Okay, all right, so that's semicircular canals. I think maybe we can get through hearing, and then next time I'll kind of recapitulate hearing a little bit. I'll make a synopsis of these different organs. All right, but let's proceed through hearing. All right, and hearing responds to not motion in your body, but actually different physical waves that move through air, pressure waves. And since it's a wave, we can measure the frequency of a wave. All right, so I guess on the board, maybe I can draw a wave. So here is a wave. All right. And we can measure the frequency if we measure the period of time from the peak of one wave to the peak of another wave. And then measure that distance, that would be the wavelength. The frequency, if we measure the time and then invert the time, that would be the frequency of a wave. So frequency and the period of a wave are inversely related to each other. As the frequency increases, the pitch increases. It becomes a higher pitch. As the frequency decreases or the distance between each wave top increases, then the pitch decreases. And intensity is the loudness of this wave. Intensity is defined from this point when it passes through zero to the peak amplitude of that wave. That's intensity or loudness. All right, and that's measured in decibels. All right, and the part of the ear that can measure sound is the cochlea, which looks like this little snail. Okay, and the cochlea, you should appreciate, really is a piano. All right, that's inside your ear, but it's not a straight piano. It's kind of all curled up because you really wouldn't want a straight piano in your ear. Why wouldn't you want two straight pianos in your ears? Well, because then they'd be sticking way outside your head, right? So they're all rolled up so they fit in there really nicely. Okay. So here we have the cochlea, and we've unrolled it. Okay, and so here we have the middle ear, here we have the outer ear, malleus, incus, and stapes in the middle ear. Here's that eustachian tube again for equalizing pressure on either side of the tympanic membrane. And the vibrations enter the oval window, and that's easy to remember because what's its shape? It's oval because that's the footprint of the stapes right there. That energy then enters the perilymph of the scala vestibuli, and it's going to move around through the cochlea, and we'll describe how that moves around. It could go all the way to the end, and that energy enters the cochlea right there, and that could be very damaging to the cochlea. It could fracture the cochlea, so there has to be a release for that energy so nothing bad happens in there. And here is the round window that can vibrate back and forth, releasing the energy that goes in. All right, so the round window is connected to the scala tympani. The third chamber that we have right here is the cochlear duct. And the cochlear duct has a different shape depending on where it is within the cochlea. Right, the end of the cochlea is what we call the helicotrema. And the helicotrema, you might think, is the narrow end, but that's actually the wide end of the cochlea. So if we were to go back a couple slides, I don't get an impression. In the book, I get an impression that the helicotrema right here is really the thick part of the cochlea, and it's sticking out. And the narrow part of the cochlea is really down over here near the base. All right, so you think of it kind of as, it's really long, but it's kind of like a wedge. And that really should remind you of like a piano or a harp or something, where you have really short, thin strings, and then you have on the other end, what, really long, thick strings. And which ones vibrate at a lower frequency, the really short ones or the really long ones? The really long ones, right? That's just a nature of the physical properties of matter. So this is the really wide part of the cochlea, this is the narrow part. So this part over here, because this is the wide part, this is the part that has a tendency to vibrate at low frequencies, and the really thin parts of the cochlea over here have a tendency to vibrate at high frequencies, and the ones that are kind of intermediate in thickness, right in the middle of the cochlea, vibrate at what? Mid-range type frequencies. All right, so different frequencies enter the cochlea, travel through the perilymph, and they will vibrate different parts of this intersection right here. That intersection is what we call the organ of Corti. That's the sensory receptor for sound. And when a certain part of the organ of Corti vibrates, then it will stimulate a certain nerve that goes to the auditory center of the brain, and you'll have the perception of that particular frequency, just like a piano. Right. Well, when you hit one key, you'll hit a high note. Hit a different key, it will be a lower note. All right, and so you can see the different frequencies of sound depending on where it lies within the organ of Corti right here. So high frequencies are at the base, low frequencies are at the helicotrema. So how does that work? We need to look at the organ of Corti. So if we look at a cross section, here's the scala vestibuli, which is connected to what? The oval window. Then sound, depending if the size and shape of this cochlear duct matches the frequency of that sound entering, it's going to vibrate the tectorial membrane, right, as it passes into the scala tympani out to the round window. All right, so we need to zoom into this structure right here to see what's actually happening. So we have the vestibular membrane here, we've got the basilar membrane right here, and we've got a tectorial membrane right in the middle of the cochlear duct. So this right here is what we call the organ of Corti, right in this region that we're going to zoom into. And look, the organ of Corti is connected to the vestibulocochlear nerve. All right, so what do we have? We have some receptor cells, and these receptor cells have cilia on them, and again, these are stereocilia, and they are actually touching the tectorial membrane. And the tectorial membrane, when it vibrates, is going to deform these cilia, changing the electrical property of this receptor cell, which is going to produce generator potentials, which then will stimulate action potentials on this auditory nerve going to the auditory cortex in the brain. And this tectorial membrane, remember, has a special shape depending on where it is in the cochlea, at the helicotrema right? This is a big, thick tectorial membrane. Down by the base, it's very thin, will vibrate at a higher frequency. All right, so these are hair cells. Where else did we run into hair cells? In the maculae for static equilibrium or linear acceleration, and also in the crista ampullaris, we saw hair cells, right, for angular acceleration or spinning. So the ear uses this kind of receptor cell, namely a hair cell, for vastly different kinds of modalities of energy, just applied in a little bit different format. Okay, so how do action potentials get to the brain? So from the spiral organ of Corti, it goes into the medulla, and there it can activate the reticular activating system. What good is that? The reticular activating system. Anybody know anything about the RAS, or reticular formation in the brainstem? That's the system that gets activated. It has reverberating circuits, so once it gets stimulated, it produces a wakeful state for a long period of time until you become fatigued. All right, but these auditory signals also go to the inferior colliculus, because you can tell where signals are coming from in space, right? Either the right side or left side of your body. That's the job of the inferior colliculus. All right, and then there's another neuron that takes it to the thalamus, because the thalamus is a relay station for sending information, for sending afferent information to the cerebral cortex. And the cortex that's for hearing, we call the auditory cortex, is in the temporal lobe. So maybe you could remember this is the temporal lobe right here. And in the temporal lobe, right, different parts will be responsible for giving you the sensation of different frequencies. So for instance, high frequencies will be over here, low frequencies will be way out over here. So if we artificially stimulate this part of the cortex, you'll hear a high frequency sound. If we stimulate way out over here, you'll hear a low frequency sound. So your auditory cortex really kind of looks like what? Looks like a piano too, or functions like a piano, right? Just by the spatial location of those neurons, right, you will hear different frequencies. And if three different frequencies come into the auditory cortex, what will you hear? You'll hear a chord, basically, right? Or one, if only one gets stimulated, you'll hear a single tone. Okay, so that's an important part for the auditory cortex is in the temporal lobe. That's an important part for hearing. Okay, so next time we're going to move on to vision after I do a little recapitulation of the ear. Talk about those three senses again. Okay, what about a sign-in sheet? Did I pass one around? Oh, good. Oh, it's down here. Excellent.